This episode of Talking Australia is brought to you by The North Face. The North Face's fundamental mission remains unchanged since 1966. Provide the best gear for athletes and the modern-day explorer, support the preservation of the outdoors, and inspire a global movement of exploration. Find more at thenorthface.com.au and The North Face Australia and New Zealand on Facebook and Instagram. Visit The North Face stores for an injection of exploration, inspiration, and to gear up for your next adventure.
If you're curious about the world around you and freedom from the crowds is your idea of luxury, then Coral Expeditions is exactly the right cruise line for you. For 34 years, Coral Expeditions have focused on taking like-minded guests to remote cultures and rarely seen natural habitats, with personal service and warm Australian hospitality. Join the Australian pioneers of expedition cruising for an intimate and unique small ship adventure experience. Their fleet of five modern vessels will take you to explore the Kimberley, Tasmanian Wilderness, Cape York, Papua New Guinea and beyond. Visit coralexpeditions.com and find your freedom. That's www.coralexpeditions.com.
Hi, I'm Justin Walker and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I am joined by Kate Leeming. Kate is an Aussie adventurer who has taken cycling to a whole new level. She cycled a distance greater than twice around the world and crossed almost every continent. In our chat today, Kate will be talking about her next major challenge, the first bicycle crossing of the Antarctic continent via the South Pole. So I'm super excited to be talking to Kate Leeming today on this episode of Talking Australia. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
I'm going to start off with the obvious question is, what got you into riding such long distances?
Well, I couldn't have imagined, you know, what I could do, when I was growing up. You know, I used to ride for fitness and I was sort of thinking about getting into triathlons at one point. And then I went across to the UK playing hockey with the idea of staying over there and sort of seeing Europe. And I always dreamed about cycling, maybe through France or Italy. I thought that would be incredible.
Yeah.
And so when I was over there with a couple of mates, I started off and just did a little trip in Ireland. And then I did a bigger trip in France. And one sort of thing led to another. And then I sort of discovered my passion. And I discovered just really what I could do on a bike. I had no idea what I could do on a bike. So I was an athlete from other different sports. Yep. And that sort of probably translated across to my new passion.
Yeah.
And so it was really just my way of seeing Europe. And over the space of the next couple of years, I did about 15,000 Ks as my own personal discovery through Europe. So some people like to, you know, take the bus or the train. And I just love this because you just really feel very connected with the people and the land. And I just love this idea of bringing a line on a map to life. And I just find that it gives a great sense of place and kind of a perspective of how everything fits together.
Yeah.
And also, especially in Europe, you can eat a lot and, you know, it doesn't cost that much to travel. And but I just loved the idea of being able to stop and take photographs, and it just seemed to mean so much more. I could remember everything, every single photo. And it's just, you know, I know if it was a beautiful day or a great experience or something was, you know, not so pleasant, or whether you passed, you know, the smells, the sights, the sounds.
Yeah, well, so you're so much more connected with the bicycle, and and people, unless you're riding a bike in Sydney, are a lot more welcoming. Always seem to have a smile on their face when they see someone on a bike, whether they've come in from outside a village or whether you're in the middle of a city, and it's just you're much more connected to where you are, like you said.
It's quite a humble sort of form of travel too, generally. So people, you know, see you riding a bike and they think, oh, they're not very wealthy or whatever, and they just it's just you come in at the level of the people. And it's just, yeah, it seems to bring out the best in people. I've had virtually no major, you know, sort of security issues. And I think, you know, people might believe that if you're riding a bike and you're a woman on her own, you're actually perceived as being pretty strong and confident. So that kind of gets rid of most of the issues.
So from that, what made you decide to undertake this huge project? Obviously, Antarctica is the end goal. That's a massive thing. It's never been done before, cycling across Antarctica via the South Pole. But you've also completed a lot of different expeditions in the meantime, building to that goal as well. So how many years has that been in the planning from when you first thought of that? When did you first think of that?
I guess I've always been interested in Antarctica ever since, you know, the learning about the heroic age of the great explorers and sort of Australia's quite well related to mm-hmm. Antarctica. And but I'd never thought it was ever going to be possible to cycle across it. It didn't really cross my mind. But then with all this other experience behind me, you know, after my first major expedition was across Russia, across from St. Petersburg to Vladivostok mm-hmm. back in 93. And that was aiding children affected by the Chernobyl disaster. Wow. So it was kind of interesting to see all this stuff with Chernobyl now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd sort of visited not Chernobyl itself, but Belarus afterwards as well, and sort of saw where the money went and, mm-hmm. and understood all the problems and was in, you know, within 11 kilometres of the border, I think it is, something like that. So there was that. Then there was the Australian expedition, which was 25,000 k's through Australia. And actually, on the Canning Stock Route, when I was looking out at Lake Disappointment, it looks like Antarctica. And it was 45 degrees, and I was in the shade. I just had this dehydration incident. And I was actually thinking, strangely enough, maybe it was positive thinking, I was thinking about Antarctica.
That's completely
true.
So the Canning Stock Route is such it's a really epic journey for someone doing four-wheel drive touring. So doing it on a bicycle, it's just, that's amazing.
Yeah, especially that people now with the advent of fat bikes, it's actually more common. Actually, people do it quite a lot, and it's now is possible to do it unsupported. But then I just had my regular bike. It was midway through a 25,000K journey through Australia, of which, you know, I just had a normal mountain bike.
Wow.
But I had a lot of interest. I'd heard about the stock route a lot. I had a great uncle who was also the second person to cycle across Australia in 1897. But he then, in 1929, reconditioned two-thirds of the stock route.
Wow.
And so I had this great interest starting out at Wiluna to follow just the little things that Uncle Willie had done. And, you know, there's, you know, where he died as well. And there's just all sorts of history and some of the wells that he had made. You know, he was commissioned to make wells at a certain size. And he did two-thirds, and his expedition was, I think, they'd run out of supplies, and he sort of buried what he had, and they returned.
Mm-hmm.
And then he couldn't come back again. His son had died in Wiluna Hospital, so he never came back to finish that.
Okay.
So that's kind of sometimes. And Canning came back, and he wasn't very complimentary about William Snell, but William did what he was asked to do.
For sure.
And he worked well with the Aboriginal people and looked after them, and something Canning probably didn't do. So anyway, we won't go into that.
No, it's funny though, but just thinking of the Canning Stock Route and just that sense of massive amounts of space and that solitude. And I mean, I know you also completed a west-east crossing of the continent of Africa as well, over 10 months and 22,000 kilometres. I mean, you must spending a lot of time by yourself on the bike must give you a lot of time to just reflect on where you are and just really experience that sense of freedom, I guess, and space and that wildness that's still out there in the world.
I absolutely love it. I mean, I grew up on a farm, a wheat and sheep farm in Western Australia, where our nearest neighbour is 5 kilometres away. So I'm kind of used to entertaining myself. Yeah. And yes, I had brothers and sisters, but we still did our own things as well. And so I especially love the deserts. So whether it's hot desert or hopefully I like the cold desert when I get there. I definitely love the open spaces. I mean, I love the Sahara as well. Mm-hmm. And I think things seem very pure in a desert, and the light's always beautiful. I've just been through Namibia, and it's just like, wow, this is really special. Whether it's, you know, life has to really struggle to survive.
Yes, yeah,
so
for sure.
I don't know whether it's that, whatever it is, but everything seems very clear in a desert.
Yep. So when you're crossing Africa, I mean, everyone thinks of, a single female on a push bike crossing a continent that's got a probably worse reputation than it should have in terms of personal safety or whatever. How dangerous was it, or was there anything that really stood out in terms of being made you sort of think, oh, what am I doing here? Should I just stop and finish it later? Or
no, that's the first expedition I did that was supported.
Yep.
And because we're wanting to film it, so it wasn't actually to do with the safety, believe it or not. I think that often travelling on a bike is actually safer than sort of the circus of having a vehicle with me. But it was very necessary there for that particular reason. And I had some pretty good plans to mitigate the risks, done massive research. I mean, I went through 20 different countries, especially along the base of the Sahara, talking about safety, base mm-hmm. of the Sahara, through Congo, and finishing through Somalia just for the finale for the security stuff. So I had a lot of, one of my plans that worked really well was that I connected with Australian resource companies that had interests in Africa, and I got small support from them financially, from lots of little junior sort of mining operators. But also they always had their bases in each country, and they had their access to their sort of the governments and their sort of Mr. Fix-It people.
Yeah, sure.
And so I sort of targeted countries that were particularly, could be difficult, and plus the start, the finish. Also, I wouldn't have got through Somalia without these contacts.
Okay.
Republic of Congo, that was another issue there that managed to get through. And so I managed to sort of work it through, and it, I mean, I got to the finish 4 days ahead of schedule after 10 months through 20 different African countries without paying a bribe.
That's excellent.
So no major injuries. Basically, it worked. And the whole idea was to show the real Africa. And,
yes.
And because as you, your first question was about security, and because we're often the stories we get in the media in particular, people are afraid.
Yeah.
And I knew that other people cycled there, so it must be possible, number one. And then when I looked at it, and I just wanted to show the real Africa, so I was looking at the causes and effects of extreme poverty, but specifically what's been done to give a leg up rather than a handout.
Yeah, sure. And that's that whole breaking the cycle.
That's where the light bulb moment came from for that that title. So I seeded the journey. I had 10 different partners, NGOs, larger organisations like PLAN or UNESCO, to small little local grassroots organisations. And so during the journey, I organised to meet up with 15 different projects. So I was covering all the key issues related to poverty during that. So I was thinking about the story as well and how to sort of create a great context. So yes, there are issues, and some, you know, some things were heartbreaking to hear when talking with refugees and people who've really had it tough and you know, going through war zones and things.
So when you rocked up on the push bike rather than in a vehicle, did everyone ask you or anyone ask you, why didn't you drive instead of riding all this way to see us?
Well, they're a bit confused, but then they thought, oh, I'm a white person on a bicycle from Australia, therefore I must be an expensive bicycle, unfortunately. Everywhere else I've been, like, going through Europe and think, oh, it's the other way around. And I was sort of a bit taken aback, but that was also a real learning process because they, you know, a lot of local people, even from the Senegal onwards, and they're sort of saying, well, look, it's amazing you can come over here and why do you care about us? But we can't, you know, we want to go to Europe. We can't do it. We're treated so much differently to you, and you're wealthy enough to actually just travel. And then it never really struck me before that we're in such, you know, a wealthy situation, but we're in such a situation
sort of
where
privileged position,
maybe that's a better word, that we can actually have the choice and to do this, to learn, to see the world, but they actually don't have those choices, and it's harder to understand. But within the first 2 weeks, I think I got that one.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So, and I had just great random conversations, you know, in the back of Senegal or in Somali.
And again, that approachability by you being on the push bike rather than in a car, away from the environment.
And you know, the local, you know, Fulani people would come up and they'd be interested in to see what we're doing. And, you know, they were wearing the most beautiful clothes that we were going, wow, this is incredible. But they're looking at us going, look at that bike. It's just a normal mountain bike. It's nothing special. But then, it's always interesting when someone travels through, even if you're in a vehicle.
For sure, interesting
to people.
Definitely. And so with the Antarctica expedition. Now, with the training and planning and preparation, it's taken a few years, and you've ticked off nearly every continent except for Antarctica along the way to make sure you're as fully prepared as you can be. So just explain a bit of that process in terms of how you've approached, like, you've been to the US and to North America, sorry.
Yeah, so I started with, okay, I'm good at the heat, but I'm not good at the cold.
Yep.
So I thought I'd get best approach people whom were experts that I could learn from them and have them with me. So Australian polar explorer Eric Phillips, I've approached Eric. So he came with us on the first journey.
Awesome.
I picked perhaps the best adventure filmmaker I could, in Claudio von Planter, whom I'd met before, and Claudio was in on it. And then we had started with another British guy, Phil Coates, who was a polar filmmaker and photographer, and we all went up to Svalbard, and we just got on like a house on fire. Yeah, it was cool. Wonderful. Lots of laughter in the tents, that's for sure. And so that was really just to go up to... then I was trying to think what kind of bike...
Okay,
obviously it has to be a fat bike to have the flotation over the soft surfaces.
Yeah, just to explain to everyone listening, the fat bike has got really wide tyres and nice inflation, so they sort of float above the snow or the sand.
Yes, so it's the biggest contact patch with the snow as possible. So you're trying to float over the surface. The widest bicycle tyres that you can get are about 13 centimetres wide, and they're pretty big. You think a normal mountain bike's about... 2 inches these days, a bit under.
5 centimetres?
So 5 centimetres. Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah, it's completely different. So then I went to North America in terms of trying to, because they're used to dealing with bicycles in the extreme cold, whereas in Australia we're not. And so that's where I started this journey of trying to find the best bike for the job. Ended up, cutting a very long story short, meeting up with a guy called Steve Christini, based in Philadelphia, who'd made a normal mountain bike with an all-wheel drive system built into it, a shaft drive system.
Ah, so instead of just pedalling and the rear wheels being driven by the chain, it actually drives the front wheel as well?
Yes, but it's actually all-wheel drive, so actually the front wheel engages when the back wheel slips.
Ah, okay.
So I don't even have to drive it all the time.
It's like traction control on the car.
It's really clever, yeah.
Yes, okay.
It's amazing, actually. And it's... he'd made this on a mountain bike, and there's a bit of a calling for that. You know, it's going downhill and things. And then he'd gone on, progressed on to his company, made motocross bikes, all-wheel drive motocross.
Okay.
And they're quite big in that area. Yep. And he hadn't made a bicycle for 10 years. And I came back to him, and he just loved the challenge because that was his real passion. And so he made the first one.
Did you say to him, look, I want to ride a bike across the entire...
Yeah, no, that's what he loved.
Can you do one for me?
Yeah. I said, look, I think I have this feeling that your technology, it looks... it's the only all-wheel or two-wheel drive technology that looks robust enough to deal with the absolutely extreme conditions. Everything else was external chains and retrofitted and didn't look efficient, and cables here and there.
Yep.
And this was all built into the frame as well. Steve... just loved the challenge. So it was just him, not his company, just making it, as in designing it. He has this absolute passion for designing. He's a great engineer.
Yeah.
And so he built the first one, but it could only hold a 4-inch wide tire on the back. Because that's what's... it's so difficult for him to get all the drive angles right and everything.
Yeah.
So he made the first one, and the four of us that I mentioned went to Svalbard and tested it, and we realised... that it's worth pursuing that.
Excellent.
And that, you know, it was very cold. I've never been in minus 30 before, and I suffer a little bit from rain hoods even, and I still managed to keep all my fingers and toes. So with a bit more learning and sort of a bit more innovation, it's a realistic dream.
Yep.
Then it took me another 3 years to get enough funding to do the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And I also published books and things in between all that. But it was definitely on, but it's just big bucks find that and to get the right skills.
Mm-hmm.
So each thing I've tried to do is always trying to create a really good story well, something that we can keep building the brand. So the second one was Northeast Greenland.
Okay.
First bike ever to ride in Northeast Greenland, going down these fjords and things. And that was just Claudio and myself, so he was filming that. And that was, I mean, it was stunning and beautiful, but it was melting a bit quicker than it was supposed to.
Yep.
And so I didn't get as much practice as we'd like, and it wasn't actually that cold. It was about 0 to -5 most of the time. So it was
chilly for Australians, but not that cold for up there.
That's right. for what I wanted.
Yeah,
and when everything's melting and I can't ride because there's like rivers. Yes. Kind of, it's not good. But it was the most stunning place.
Excellent.
And then the next year I managed to find enough funding to do number 3. So we tested fat bike number 3, which did have the widest tyre possible. Now, so number 2 had 4.8-inch wide tyres, which is generally the widest bar this one type. And we still wanted to get the widest, the biggest flotation possible, because that's more important than anything, actually. So went to Arctic Canada, Claudio and I, with fat bike number 3, cycling over the Beaufort Sea and things like that.
Oh, is that in the Yukon?
Yeah, Yukon.
Yep.
So that's northwest, so up to the mouth of the Mackenzie River.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yep. So up the Dempster Highway, and then like from Fort McPherson, Aklavik, we took, you know, followed the sort of most westerly channel, Peel Channel, I think yep. it was, of the Mackenzie River out to the sea, basically, oh, over wow. the sea to a place called Shingle Point.
The terrain there, is that as close as you've got to what Antarctica will be like well, in terms I think of underneath your wheels and things like that?
Antarctica's different in that mostly it's on the plateau,
yep.
which is at altitude. So mm-hmm. we're looking at more like 3,000 metres or nearly
wow.
for most of it. So that will be a bit different to going over the sea, mm-hmm. apart from maybe a bit of the ice shelf. But
sure.
but the cold was really, it was really cold, yep. like it was minus 20 most of the time. So actually that's kind of, if I could, that was realistic. In fact, Eric Phillips seems to think that up there in the Arctic, it's sort of a wetter cold, which is a damp cold, which
okay.
he thinks feels colder than in Antarctica, where you've got that 24-hour daylight.
Yes.
So I trust Eric. Yeah.
And then next was Namibia, is that right?
With the sand, not quite. So then, so that was 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And then I still didn't have the funds for Antarctica. And I thought, and I've been developing an education program called Breaking the Cycle Education.
Yep.
And so I'm trying to infuse and really realize a lot more of the value of what I was doing. Those first three polar training journeys were just for polar training.
Yes. Yeah.
And so set this up with the idea of doing a preparatory expedition on every continent, bar Antarctica, obviously.
Yep.
And the, being preparatory, it could be polar. It could be at altitude or in sand, because cycling in sand is very similar to cycling yes. in snow. So it's physical, mental training. It's also keeping me expedition fit mentally sure. in particular.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, mentally, it must be yeah. hard when you're by yourself for so long. It's very hard riding in sand and snow, as you've just said. I mean, how do you keep yourself focused on that goal when it's still another 1,000 kilometres to go and the wind's coming into you, you're facing a headwind and everything
yeah.
else, everything that cyclists just absolutely hate?
Yes. So you've got to, I guess with every single expedition, number one thing is to be really sure about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and having a good reason to do so. And then usually by the time I've got to the start point, I've had to fight so hard for it to happen, to find the funding, to pull everything together. It's absolutely crazy. So that's number one. Then I guess on the journey, I have all sorts of techniques, but just the one that I've just done, for example, in Namibia. So this is the first time anyone's ever cycled the entire coastline, and people have done a little bit on the Skeleton Coast, but not very much.
Okay.
And for many reasons, getting permits and it was massive to actually make this happen. And the first 3 days, I think it was the full moon, but it's supposed to be, it's notoriously windy. It's like the yeah. Fremantle Doctor on steroids.
Yeah, wow.
And more, unbelievable, continuous from the all day. And then the only place I was hoping to be able to ride on the beach
yep.
most of the time, but the trouble is that it's very, you know, it's obviously the tides
yes,
rotate every 12 hours. And so for a little bit of time when that's possible, but then the waves are enormous, so there's you can't, like I'm trying to dodge the waves all the time. And then as the tide, after a couple of hours, the tide's coming back in again, then I'm basically on the soft sand and the softer stuff. So I'm just spending my whole time trying to find there's little bays as well, so you go over these soft bits and yeah. And then there's the seals, lots of seals sitting there, and they get a little bit of a shock when I'm coming past them on a bike. But yeah, back to the mental side. So those first 3 days were just, I was really new, I was in an expedition, and I had to do 50 Ks a day to make it
okay.
work in time. And I thought, this is also Antarctica-like too in terms of what I'm looking to do, 40 minimum,
yes.
50.
Yeah.
And it was a struggle because I'd been a little sick before because I pushed it too hard to get to the start. But I still just set it out, just yeah, break wow. it into little goals.
Yes,
okay. I'm trying not to look at my speed or anything because yep. I get competitive and I think, oh, God, I'm only going 5 Ks an hour, 6 Ks an hour. It's just, you know, it's just what it is. I've just
yes.
got to keep going
mm-hmm.
and, you know, divert. It's actually riding on roads is probably mentally harder for me
yes,
than
okay.
when you're actually on just
in the wild, or
in the wild on surface, on uneven surfaces, because all the time I'm just focusing on trying to find the right path, so my mind's very busy.
It occupies your mind.
And when it's soft surfaces, you don't actually know what's underneath all the time. So I'm trying to read the surfaces, and I'm trying to get the gearing right, because I'm trying to keep it in a very light gear, so that when I hit something, like a ditch or whatever, that I can power out of it. And then, you know, thinking about my just my body positions and breaking it up, and trying to just gauge the effort level.
Sure.
Because I have to be able to gauge that to be able to keep going. And it's really about keeping in quite a light gear to keep going through the sand or the snow. Same. The technique is exactly the same. It's about having a very strong body core.
Yep. I guess you never think of the end when you're in a hot bath with your feet up and it's all over. You try not to think about
it. No, absolutely. It does not help. It does not help. But especially when the bigger expeditions, where I know there are certain things ahead that I really want to see, it helps to visualise those.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, I kind of think of all the people who've put their support behind it as well. And, you know, it's been my idea, so I kind of feel pretty proud of that. But then, you know, I think, oh, all these people are here or watching because it's me, so I've got to actually make sure I I do my part.
Yeah.
But it's not just me, really, in terms of making it happen.
So the other question I had for you on your fitness, and I know you've had a lot of operations on one of your knees as well, and you know, but also in Antarctica, keeping yourself, how can I say, warm, but without sweating too much, because the cold wind, and there's all those factors to take into consideration. So how difficult is that to plan for when you... But it's such a unique weather pattern down there, I guess.
Yeah, so obviously, yes, you're absolutely right. So when I'm on the bike in the snow, I'm working really, really hard, and yet the wind chill factor is massive. So it's about sort of keeping the wind off but still having breathability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of very difficult. Lots of layers, I think, and wool blends are pretty good, but then wool also... is damp, gets damp very quickly. But I do find that warmer. And I've actually just been experimenting, actually in Namibia though, it's infrared. Oh. So it's actually a base layer that has infrared built into the
fabric.
And what it does, it's because 65% of your body heat is wasted, and so this basically traps it and basically recirculates the heat. And so therefore it stimulates the circulation within each cell. So I was just using this to help with recovery. Sure. And I must say I backed up really well every day.
Okay.
Like it's quite a thing to be quite fit and then start one of these and do 8 hours a day in sand into the wind. And, you know,
imagine.
all of those things. So I'm quite impressed.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And so the next leg, or the last continent, is South America, and it's altitude starting up north and going all the way down through the Andes and...
So I've sort of, I do actually have to work as well, so I can't, next March, April, all of these journeys I've been planning, they're supposed to be standalone expeditions on their own, and I always, so with this one, it's always about creating a story as well.
Sure.
So I'm starting from Cusco, and then sort of winding my way through the Peruvian, the southern mountains of southern Peru, and then into sort of Bolivia, across the Altiplano, but sort of on the border with Chile.
Okay.
And there's lots of volcanoes down there. Some of them have old sulfur mines up high up.
Yep.
And tracks. Some of those tracks aren't maintained, but I've got my eye on doing three of these climbs up. Three out of four of the ones that I've researched. So that goes up. Like the Altiplano is at 3,750 metres is the average altitude. And three of these volcanoes or these tracks go up to at least 5,700 metres.
Excellent.
Not a lot of oxygen up there.
But people don't realise, like you said earlier, Antarctica is mostly at 3,000 metres or above or around that level. So you're higher from the start, really, aren't you?
And in the cold, the... it seems higher. It makes the altitude seem higher, maybe 1,000 metres higher, so they say. So, but it's also practicing going into those kind of places, practicing focusing. You know, I've been to Ladakh, for example, and cycled to nearly 5,400 metres a few times. And I just know how hard it is. So to be able to keep pushing when there isn't much oxygen around, I think at 3,700 metres there's about 13% oxygen in the air.
Wow. At
6,000 metres there's about 10%.
A lot less.
Yeah. So anyway, three of those volcanoes down through the Puna de Atacama, which is the high Atacama, finishing at Hoyas del Salado, which is the highest volcano in the world.
Okay.
And the idea is to get as high up it as I can. It's not a technical climb for anyone climbing. Sure. I know of a guy on a fat bike who cycled basically up as far as 6,200 metres there. And I don't propose, I don't know what can be done. The weather conditions can change or whatever, but I think it's a very nice way to finish the expedition, or a good sort of finish.
Yeah. So part of the Breaking the Cycle education program for that leg will be what exactly?
Well, this one I'm looking at the importance of girls' education and girls and women's empowerment, and I'm looking to seed the story, a bit like in Africa, looking to seed the story with some very specific interactions, one at La Rinconada, which is the world's highest city, or built on unregulated gold mining at 5,100 metres. So I have a very good filmmaker, so he'll just be with me on a motorbike. I'm just sort of setting that up now.
Okay.
There's a bit to do.
Yeah, sure.
But organising the cycling bit and the route, that's easy. That's easily done. And then I have an educator who specialises in teaching the Sustainable Development Goals. So for the last expedition, she set up a whole series of 10 lessons for that. And this time we'll do a whole nother series of lessons for this.
Awesome.
Yeah,
and then after that, it's the big one.
Yeah, so it's just pulling these things together, and that just keeps me very sharp.
Yes,
and you know, we're making a documentary about the Namibian expedition, which is just, there's so many wonderful things. We think we've got enough for an hour.
Wow.
We'll do a tour of that next year.
Okay.
Have the funding for that. There's always this time of having to get funding.
Yeah.
and then I think we've got the other one, the South American one, coming together pretty well.
Okay.
I mean, that's still 6 months out, so
sure.
That's good. But at the meantime, it doesn't stop trying to pull Antarctica together.
Yeah, sure.
So
yeah, it must be, I guess Antarctica is still that great unknown, isn't it, especially on a bicycle. Are any of the explorers you've spoken to said, oh, it can't be done, or they all sort of said, yes?
No, we think it can be done. Because, I mean, four people have cycled to the South Pole.
Okay.
So they've done substantial expeditions there, and it's really just a matter of keeping going and
the other side.
Yeah, I mean, the very simplest, the shortest route is about 1,800 kilometres, and it would start from Leverett Glacier, which is at the base of the Ross Ice Shelf, is there, and starting from there, basically following the South Pole Overland Traverse up to to the South Pole, which is basically, it's a flagged route that the Americans used to go from McMurdo Base on the coast, real coast, to the South Pole, and they sort of do an overland traverse during the summer to take supplies up there. So it makes sense on a bicycle to follow that.
Yes.
And then down the other side would go as far as Hercules Inlet, so it's near Union Glacier.
Wow.
So that's about 1,100 k's down there, a bit over 1,150, I think. So that, if I really had my way, I'd love to really start at McMurdo.
Yep.
So that would follow that route, basically the Americans' route, all the way. So it's an extra 1,000 kilometres in there.
That's exciting.
And always it's into the wind, essentially, to the South Pole.
Lucky you've been to Namibia.
Well, absolutely. I think I'm going to get some in South America too. But, into the wind on the way up.
Yep.
And roughly speaking, with the wind on the way down.
Okay.
But also sort of on especially that first part of the way down, it's not really down, it's a lot of sastrugi, and it's a lot of difficult stuff.
Sure.
Could get some soft snow and things like that. So, but the all-wheel drive fat bike actually works best on sastrugi and stuff. The stuff that eats it for breakfast, it's amazing.
Yeah, right.
That's where it's really good.
Interesting.
So
just one other question. Your parents? What do they think of all this? Do they just shake their heads and laugh? And
No. I guess one of the hardest things I always have to do is tell them because they worry because they're normal parents.
Yep.
So I guess they have to, so what I try and do is make sure that I don't tell them until it's really on, as in, and then that I've absolutely done everything that I can to mitigate all the risks, which is, but for them too. And all my expeditions are finished on time, touch wood, on budget, and sort of no major injuries.
Yep.
And basically the key missions achieved. So that's good. Unfortunately, my father passed away last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a week before I was due to go to Ladakh.
Okay.
And with family, I sort of went across, I'm West Australian, went across home straight away, and we decided, my dad had supported this, and yep. So we just decided, my family gave me the blessing, said I should do it rather than sit around, so it was very, very hard. And we did a special expedition up there, and it's quite a spiritual place. And the expedition also to electrify a remote village, one of the most remote villages in the region with solar power. And I was taking part in that. And so that was all dedicated to my father as well.
Excellent.
So that was very nice.
That's great.
And that's with the Namibian one that's not quite finished yet either, because now those partners up there, we're together working with my Namibian partner to electrify Piros village, which is in the northwest, a very poor village in the northwest, which I visited. So they're all going to get solar power.
Fantastic.
All 118 houses. So we need some takers for that too next year.
So there's been no real, there wouldn't be a favourite trip you've ever done. They're all so different, aren't they?
You can't really
compare them, and they all would be fantastic.
I always say it's just the last one that I've done, but I don't know. Like, they're all, I try and make them all special because you don't get a chance to do them again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a privilege to do it, and you know, I mean, I love that last trip I've just done, and I'm sure the next one's going to be good, and I can't wait for Antarctica either. But you know, Africa's become very special, as has my own country, I guess. It's just a very intimate way to explore a country and to get a feel for how it all fits together, as I keep saying. But You can't help but change a little bit. Every journey changes you a bit, and I have to sort of, you know, have to push and work hard to make it happen, and sort of push through some tough times. But there's always that goal and kind of self belief that it's going to. It's important to finish it off. You can't just half finish something somewhere. Then it's like you set a precedent to half finish other things. So it's got to try.
I don't think you lack any self belief, and we're all going to be following you all the way to Antarctica now. So. Well, thanks for spending time with us today, Kate, and I really hope that it all happens as it should do, which I'm sure it will.
Thank you. Yes, it's going to happen.
Awesome. Thanks very much for taking some time with us.
Thanks very much, Justin.
All right, thanks. That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Kate Leeming. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.